ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Corbin Middlemass here. What's going on with the cricket? Well, that's what the ABC Cricket Podcast is for, with me and my sparring partner, Ed Cowan. Who's been selected?
You got another 100 during the week.
Who's been rejected?
So obviously, if he's not fit enough.
And who has the best grade cricket salad roll?
What was the key? The quality of the cheese or the bun?
The bun was always fresh, or the salad inside nice and soft.
Search for the ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here. This week, I'm speaking with ABC presenters and journalists about their best stories and interviews from 2025. I'm joined by Alan Kohler, Stephanie March, Matt Bevan, and Lee Sales. Today, it's Sarah Ferguson, host of 7:30, with insights from her big name interviews. Sarah, before we get underway, I just want to ask you, do you have any idea how many interviews you've actually done this year? Because I'm guessing it is a lot.
You know, it makes me think, Sam, we don't actually have a list. We should have a single list. I think it's going to be about 200.
Oh, my gosh.
Which makes me feel a little like I need a lie down.
Well, because, and you are, I've just got to say, you are a wonderful interviewer, and we're very grateful that we have you there on 7:30. Now, we have before, Sarah, of course, discussed your interview with Kamala Harris, but you have sat down with so many others. I just want to start with the fun one first. Gary Oldman, I loved this because you had to ask him a farting question.
Does every audience in the world love a good fart joke?
I think so.
Wonderful.
It's funny. We love a good fart joke. And I think it's all part of the spycraft.
Well, you know, you say have to. I chose to ask him a farting question, but right. I will say, you know, it's important not to talk about ourselves as journalists. However, I would like to make claim to this that I said fart and Stephen Colbert said flatulence. So I think we win for directness.
Oh, absolutely. You had the guts to say it.
I reckon. Fully Australian, that is.
That's great. You interview quite a few celebrities over the year. They're quite fun, aren't they? Do you enjoy doing those?
It depends. So part of the problem with celebrity interviews is they're often presented in junket form, you know, where you're basically in a queue. And since COVID, people learned about Zoom. So it's essentially a Zoom queue. And then you have a specified number of minutes, two often bored-looking celebrities hearing the same questions over and over. So the effort to try and project knowledge and the fact that you can, if it's actors, speak actor and that you care about their craft and you don't care about who they're dating takes an enormous amount of effort. And they're often at odd hours of the day, so I'm usually doing them at home with my pajama bottoms on. So they're not always richly rewarding. Yeah. When they're proper interviews standalone, yes.
I think I know it the same way any filmmaker knows it when they see something and it's undeniable up on screen. I don't think I've ever been in a movie in which everybody was secretly hoped, geez, I hope we have that luminous quality, you know, shared between us. And it can come out.
Tom Hanks, wonderful interview, super generous. James Cameron, the Avatar director.
And in fact, I would say that I'm successful in shielding them from a lot of the technical aspects of filmmaking that the average actor has to deal with.
Some of the others, pajamas, home, junket, not so great.
Yeah, I can understand that. All right, well, why don't we delve into some of the interviews you've done this year? Now, one of them was with Mike Huckabee, who's been appointed, of course, by Donald Trump as the US ambassador to Israel. Now, you did this interview before the ceasefire was reached. But just tell me, what was the significance in your mind, firstly, in securing this interview, because he doesn't have to talk to Australian journalists, of course.
No, he doesn't. But there is always, this is always the case, as you know, with Americans, it's all about how and when they exercise their power and who with and what they get out of it. This was just after Australia had joined other key allies, Canada, UK, France, committing to recognition of a Palestinian state. And it was pretty clear the Americans were going to be very unhappy about this. And Huckabee was obviously chosen directly by Donald Trump, very close to Trump. So it was a chance to get a sense of what Donald Trump thought about the situation. And quite quickly out of the gate, he used the word disgust to describe the U.S. response to the decision. It's an unusual word to use.
And we've discussed it at the State Department level with the secretary. There's an enormous level of disappointment. And some disgust.
Disgust, that's a big one. You don't hear that, especially from, you know, a diplomatic person in a diplomatic position very often.
And just if I could come back, you used the word disgust. That's a very strong term. Who expressed disgust? Was that the president?
I don't know that the president used that word. I would say that it is a characterization of the sentiment. Whether or not that word was employed by anybody in particular other than me, I think it does express, though, the emotional sentiment, a sense of you've got to be kidding. Why would they be doing this? And why would they be doing it now? And why wouldn't they not be telling the United States or telling Israel, for that matter? But to go out and make a public announcement like this, it was unseemly.
And he sounded during the interview like he was frustrated.
He certainly did. They were also angry at the same time because they'd been on a big visit to the UK and Keir Starmer didn't tell them that, to them, that they were going to make this call. The frustration is interesting because the signs were so strong from Australia that this was building during the year that it just cannot have taken them by surprise. But the isolation, you know, whatever the US thinks about the UN, being further isolated in the UN by significant allies, it was a very important moment.
Yeah, and that was a point that you put to him, wasn't it? That the US was becoming increasingly isolated.
Of course, you know, as the people who think they exert the most power in the world, they'll never see it in those terms. But there must be, you know, there's obviously a source of the disgust. Now, of course, one of the answers he gave was that this was such a bad idea because rather than stopping the thing that Australia said at the time that it was fearful of, he claimed that actually this decision would push Israel to annex the West Bank, which was actually a very substantial claim on his part. He also wanted to make the case, a difficult case to make, that the US had no leverage over how the war was conducted.
Does not the United States' very large military aid, billions and billions of dollars to Israel, give you some leverage over how the war is conducted?
I guess if we wanted to tell them what to do, we would, but they're our partner. We respect the fact that they were attacked on October the 7th. They're not the attacking country. They were the
He wanted to talk really only about the fact that this decision was ill-timed because the hostages had not yet been released and were still being tortured or subjected to awful conditions.
So why doesn't the US have anything to say about the huge extent of civilian casualties in Gaza?
We do. We have a lot to say about it. The first thing we say is Hamas should have surrendered on October the 8th. That would have ended this war and there wouldn't have been civilian casualties.
All right. What did you take away then from that interview, Sarah? What really kind of stuck with you?
Well, this is interesting. I think that question of leverage is very important because he wanted to say just the fact that the US arms Israel doesn't necessarily mean that it has leverage over Israel, which is quite an extraordinary claim.
Yeah.
I think one of the biggest challenges, Sam, with an interview like this is that you've got limited time. Someone like that is only going to give you a small amount of time. And their style is, you know, it is a little bit of Steve Bannon's kind of, you know, flood the zone. So they just keep talking. They keep asserting the same points. So the question is, how much can you get in to challenge factual inaccuracies on the run? I think this is one of the big questions with these interviews.
Yeah.
How often should you stop them? So he said, for example, that one of the problems with the decisions was that it would interrupt the Oslo process when Netanyahu had said that he was proud to have put the brakes on Oslo. So that's the question.
Yeah.
He's fierce. He's not going to give any quarter. At the same time, you need to ask questions but how many of the what I would regard as factual inaccuracies can you let go by? That's really the question about the conduct of these complex interviews.
All right, well, let's rewind now. When you sat down with the former New Zealand Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, now, she'd just written a memoir, and it was a really personal look at her time during her leadership. Why was this discussion important in your mind?
So she had raised the question whether or not it is possible to be a leader, to assume a position of importance in political leadership, and to do it in a way that puts empathy at the centre of it. Mm. So a less archly political or combative form of leadership, but something that puts sense of people and how they're feeling, empathy, at the heart of it. Now, it's a big contention, because politics is always going to be full of combat. The contest of ideas itself is a form of combat, and then politics itself, being so at its absolute heart, is only about numbers. Can you get the numbers to come with you in support of a particular decision? And that will necessarily need hard decisions, and leads to hard decisions that disadvantage people. So it's a big assertion. That's why I thought it was important, because I wanted to figure out how far that compassion can work in politics.
I rather was convinced that if I was going to write anything, it should really be a story about how it feels to lead, because, you know, who knows who's out there considering whether or not they have what it takes, considering whether or not they can succeed if they lead with empathy, and perhaps who may have lost a bit of faith in politics or politicians.
Mm. And what was fascinating about this interview as well, and this memoir, is that she really outlines that she never, for a very long time, felt good enough to actually become a politician. You know, she called it imposter syndrome.
She described it as a light bulb moment when she actually first heard the term, because to her it seemed to describe something that she felt.
You're saying that you think a lot of people actually think this.
Well, also, I think I'm trying to encourage others, because, you know, ultimately, even if you have that confidence gap in yourself, it does not mean that you cannot and will not be a decisive leader. Really, I want to bring into question these old assumptions about the character traits we want in politics. I do think people are seeking more kindness, more empathy, and these are not traits that you cannot coexist with the idea of strength and courage as well.
She describes grappling her whole life with the concept, with the idea really that she was never quite good enough and that she would be caught out or found out or caught short in what she was doing. But then she goes on to say that led her to very significant amounts of preparation, so that there is a way to combat it. So it's not just that she came through with this unusual sort of lack of self-belief, the very opposite of what we think most politicians have, which is a lot, if not too much, self-belief. So this is her trying to make the case that this is the personality that she had evolved with, but she managed to make it work, and that you can be a politician even if you are thin-skinned, because we also assume that because of some of the awful parts of politics, that you must have this thick carapace to survive, be what the French call blandé, you know, armoured like a tank to survive. And she's saying that's not true. You can just be an ordinary person who feels loss and defeat very acutely and still be a successful politician.
Yes, but as a woman, of course, she still clearly faced challenges along the way, just as we saw with Julia Gillard here. Now, sexism, of course, during the leadership, she had this interview at one point where she really had to push back against this radio guy who deemed that she had some sort of obligation to reveal her reproductive plans.
If you're an employer of a company, you need to know that type of thing from the women that you're employing, because legally, legally, you have to give them maternity leave. So therefore, the question is it okay for a PM to take maternity leave while in office?
You don't find this an inappropriate question?
For me, no, because I opened myself up to it. But you,
For other women, it is totally unacceptable in 2017 to say that women should have to answer that question in the workplace.
Well, this is
that
my
is
point.
Unacceptable.
No,
that is unacceptable. Okay. 2017. It is a woman's decision about when they choose to have children. It should not predetermine whether or not they are given a job or have job opportunities.
That's just one pretty stark example, isn't it?
Let me just tell you something that is really fascinating that I only understood sort of reading the book and then speaking to her. Jacinda Ardern has the most elevated emotional intelligence. It is literally a superpower in her. Mm. So for all of that uncertainty, what she has is the ability to read a situation with terrific acuity. And this is why we know her for scenes like that big moment in Christchurch when she, wearing a scarf, hugs victims of the Christchurch massacre. So in that scene that you're talking about, when this man asked this ludicrous thing about her producing her reproductive plans, she doesn't just push back in a kind of I'm angry and it's not good enough way. Mm. She knows exactly how to formulate that to push back so that people will be on her side. I'm not suggesting any of this is insincerity. She really does have extraordinary emotional intelligence, which is the root of much of her success in politics.
I had had a lot of those kinds of questions before, and maybe in that moment it came to a head.
But you don't regret it, do you?
No, not at all. Not at all. Like, there was a real sense for me in that moment, though, of, yeah, it's fine for me, but what about everyone else? Because I don't think anyone for a moment would assume that when an employer asks you your plans, it's not because they're going to prepare the gift basket for you. It's because it may make a change in their employment decision. So, you know, let's be honest about that. And I do think we should be in a day and age where that is not entertained as being a line of questioning that's acceptable.
Mm, well, in a sense, I guess she did end up being more popular abroad than she did at home. And that was because, of course, a lot of her policy agenda was never really achieved. But what is it? Is her legacy more her style, this idea of a leader with empathy? And, I mean, do we have anyone here like that?
It's a good question. I mean, I think the fact that she wants to talk about the personal, I think this does go back to the emotional intelligence thing. She wants to talk about the fact that as a female leader, she has morning sickness. She discovers she's pregnant when she's negotiating for the role. She has morning sickness on the day that she's been sworn in. She actually throws up into a toilet.
Yes.
And she's able to talk about those things and do it in a way that people listening, I think, would think, well, then it's okay for me to give this a go, even if I'm a woman who's either got children or thinking of having children. It's okay. You can manage it. And I think that appeal to the, in a sense, to the ordinariness of people's lives, the things that we all do, that is her, again, her power in politics and what she was looking to do, which is to get other people to hear that and say, well, maybe that could be me. And I wonder whether the teal independence, the independence, they don't like that term as we know, but the independence in Australia, I'm not saying it's a direct comparison, but there is a comparison there. You know, the question was often put to them, do you want to do this? And for some of them, they hadn't considered a career in politics.
Yes.
And along comes people saying, no, you fit,
yes,
particularly as a woman and with the background that you have, you fit this. And I think that's all part of the same piece. So I'm not saying we've got a direct copy of Jacinda Ardern, but I think that female rush of candidates is clearly indicative of a deep change in politics in New Zealand and in Australia.
All right, well, Sarah, of course, AI was just such a massive issue for 2025, and you sat down for a really very fascinating interview with Scott Farquhar. Now, he's the chair of the Tech Council of Australia. Just tell me, just give me, first of all, just so we understand who this is, you know, what's his background?
So, obviously, one of the founders of the software giant Atlassian, along with Mike Cannon-Brookes.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is the case that people in tech companies so rarely do interviews. Now, as the chair of the Tech Council, puts him in a position where he should be doing interviews, should be talking about particularly issues around AI.
Mm.
But not particularly used to doing interviews that are sort of politics adjacent.
Yes.
So to begin with, you know, we talked about people had started then to really talk about some of the crazy scenarios in relation to AI and AI taking over from humans. Mm. It's interesting to know that he doesn't pay too much heed to those crazy scenarios and sees really almost all upside. But then we start talking about more complicated things that are to do with the legal situation around AI, obviously copyright and so on. And then I think the interview shifts and he finds himself in a slightly more unfamiliar territory.
Yeah, that's right. So you're really sort of pushing him on the regulation of this copyright idea of AI sweeping the internet and just taking music, for instance.
How do you explain to Australian artists that an AI company using their material without recompense is not theft?
So I think everyone would agree if you use AI to copy an artist directly and, you know, create a song in their style, that's probably not fair use. I do think people would say that, hey, if people are going to sit down with a digital companion, an AI, you know, song creator, and they collaboratively work with an AI to create something new to the world, that's probably fair use. And so I do think we should have this conversation around, as a society, what do we want the fair use to be?
But right now, AI companies are just gobbling up all of that material for free. That's what the artists are calling theft. Do you think that should stop?
I think that the benefits of the large language models and so forth that we've got outweigh, like, you know, those issues. So
hang on, you're saying that the benefits of the large language models outweigh the rights of individual Australian artists to create distinct Australian content?
I think you're saying, do I think that these models going out and training themselves on the entire internet?
Yes.
Like, I think there are benefits to that. We have to work out what is fair use for these AI models.
And he kind of gets a bit uncomfortable, but he's really sticking to his guns.
So he has this really quite extraordinary position. Exactly as you say, I'm putting to him the question about Australian artists and their copyright not having all of it just gobbled up for free. And his view is that the greater good determines that people should have their copyright, all their material just gobbled up for free. So I put to him the obvious question, you know, when you were younger and you were coming up with ideas to power Atlassian, if someone had come along and taken your idea and used it with no financial recompense, you know, a new use case for what you were doing with no thanks to you, would you have been okay with it? And his answer was yes, as long as it's transformative.
As a society, we say that everyone gets copyright.
What about you, Scott Farquhar, at that time with something that you had created through your own skill, blood, sweat and tears? If someone had come along and taken that from you and used it to benefit themselves with no benefit to you, you would have thought that was fair?
If it had been transformative, yes. If someone had used my intellectual property to compete with me, then I think that is an issue, like directly with me. If they'd used all the intellectual property of all the software on the world to help people write software better in the future, like, I think that is a fair use.
Quite a stunning idea, I think, that as long as the result for humanity is transformative, then there should be no recompense. We have to accept that, as he claims, it's for the greater good and that's enough.
Yeah. So he just wouldn't sort of listen to the argument.
Wouldn't budge.
It was semi-frustrating to watch.
Yes, which is not ideal. You kind of want to get in a position where you're either rooting for the idea or him, or, you know, you don't want it to be unsatisfactory. But I think this goes back to the question of, he may have had plenty of debates in his life about the use of intellectual property, but it's a, you know, he gave the example of when iPods came out and it was illegal to take a CD that you owned and put it on an iPad because that was illegal in the Copyright Act, you know, something that now we would regard as silly.
Yeah.
But I think this question of people in business not doing interviews, not being prepared to make their case to the Australian people, I think it's a flaw. It's been the case for a long time. We don't get a lot of interviews from big business. And clearly with AI, that's something that we're going to need.
Mm. All right. Well, Sarah, I'm sure you're looking forward to a break because it's been a year, a long one, because I know this is weird. There was an election this year.
I mean, honestly, are you sure? Can you prove it?
It feels like a lifetime ago.
It does feel like
there's been a lot.
What is that? What is that about the movement and measure of time?
I know. I do hope that you have a lovely holiday or a break.
Thank you.
And looking forward to watching the show next year.
And thank you for the podcast. You really bring us so many fascinating voices. It's truly a marvellous thing. Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah.
Sarah Ferguson is host of the ABC's 7:30 program. Find her interviews on ABC iView. This episode was produced by Sydney Peed, audio production by Cinnamon Nippard. Our supervising producer is David Cody. Find my other discussions from this week with ABC journalists and presenters, including Lee Sales, Matt Bevan and others, on the ABC Listen app. Next week, we'll bring you some of our favourite episodes of ABC News Daily from 2025. And we'll be back with the latest news from January the 5th. I'm Sam Hawley. Thanks for listening.